All right, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Judges. We left off in chapter 11, and we're continuing to go through the portion of scripture about the various judges that ruled Israel during this period of time when, you know, it says that the people, basically a lot of them just did what was right in their own eyes. They continuously were backsliding, got back into their old ways. And God just had to constantly chastise them until they turn around and come back to him. I think what's kind of interesting is that we're going to be reading about a guy tonight called Jephthah. He was one of the judges of Israel, and he was an illegitimate child, and he was pretty much ostracized by his family and by society. But, God raised him up in a very unique way, and I think that there's a very profound message and a very encouraging message for a lot of people today. Let's just get right into it. I'll show you what I mean. When we begin with chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead was the father of Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, 'You shall not have any inheritance in our father's house, for you are a son of another woman.' So Jephthah fled from his brothers, and he lived in the land of Tob. And worthless fellows gathered themselves around Jephthah, and they went out with him. And it came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. And it happened that when the sons of Ammon fought against Israel, that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, 'Come and be our chief, that we may fight against the sons of Ammon.' Then Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, 'Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me when you are in trouble?' And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, 'For this reason we have now returned to you, that you may go with us and fight with the sons of Ammon and become our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead.' So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, 'If you take me back and fight against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gives them up to me, will I become your head?' And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, 'The Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do to you as you have said.' Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all the words before the Lord at Mizpah." Now, before we go any further, let's just give you an overview of what's really taking place here, because I think it's pretty significant. Here we've got Jephthah. He's an illegitimate child, and you know what the Bible says? If you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, I think it's kind of significant. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, this is what God said about illegitimate children. He said, "No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord." And then he went on to say, "No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord." And here's the thing, okay? What God was trying to tell these people, you got to understand something, okay? Because you always got to look at what it says in the New Testament, especially in the third chapter of Galatians, where Paul basically says, look, all of this was given for our instruction. All the law was given to us as our tutor to teach us things, okay? So what was God trying to teach his people when he said that an illegitimate child was to be ostracized from the assembly of the Lord? They could not partake in the worship. What he was trying to say to them is this: unless you become born again, unless you become a legitimate child of God, you are never going to see heaven. That's the message. That's what a tutor is trying to tell us. That's what our teacher is trying to teach us, all right? It's not that God has something against illegitimate children by any means, all right? We've got to understand that. And I think what's kind of significant is, I don't know if you guys seen this clipping in Sacramento Bee 3 weeks ago. It says, "Births to unwed mothers climb to a U.S. record." In other words, there's more illegitimate children being born today than ever. And, of course, I won't read the whole article, but it says, "Out of wedlock births in the United States have climbed to an all-time high, accounting for nearly 4 in 10 babies born last year," the government health official said. And then it goes on to say about 4.1 million babies were born in the United States last year, and it up slightly from 2004. It says more than 1.5 million of those were unmarried women. And that's about 37%. But you know what it doesn't tell you, too, is that 1.5 million children were aborted, and how many of those were, illegitimate as far as their conception was concerned. And it just says that out of wedlock births have been rising ever since the late 1990s. Now, here's the thing, okay? We got to understand something. God doesn't have anything against an illegitimate child. And in a sense, there is no such thing as an illegitimate child. What it is that they're illegitimate parents. But back in, obviously, the days of Jephthah, an illegitimate child carried quite a stigma. But I think it's kind of significant because this guy was a marked man. He was thrown out by his brothers. And I think it was kind of significant, too, because, Jesus, of course, he was called a glutton, he was called a drunkard, he was called demon-possessed, and one of the blind men that he healed, they associated that blind man as being born altogether out of wedlock when his parents had made reference to the fact that, yeah, that was our son and he was born blind. And, I think that was kind of inferring that even Jesus was illegitimate. I mean, he just called everything in the book, all right? And I think what God is trying to point out here is that this guy had a lot going against him. And I look at today and look at all the illegitimate children that are being born. And believe me, they have a lot going against them. Because all the statistics, every single survey, every single research that has been done points out conclusively that a child who has a two-parent intact family, a mother and a father, male and female, okay, even if they are living under the poverty line, their children do much better in school, less discipline problems. They are healthier emotionally. They do better financially. In every single category, these children have an advantage. But, of course, the media is the only going to shove in our face people like these Hollywood stars that have children out of wedlock. Well, they've got multi-million dollars, but they don't even have to worry about raising their kids and making ends meet because they just pay some nanny to raise their kids. But what it's really doing is destroying the family. But still, God can salvage anything. And I think that even look at the number of men in prison today. Well over 80% of the men in prison are there because they didn't have a father figure. And that's just a flat-out truth. So you see a man like this, God hasn't written a man like this off at all. As a matter of fact, he chooses a man like this to save his people. And I think it's kind of significant that this guy, what happened is that he was run out of town on a rail by his brothers. Saying, you're not going to have any part in our inheritance. You're a bastard. You're illegitimate. We got nothing to do with you. So what does he do? He surrounds himself with a bunch of guys who have just become almost like outlaws. And he becomes one bad dude with a bad reputation. And nobody messed with Jephthah. And the sons of Ammon are now encroaching upon the sons of Israel. And they are really, really a threatening army. And they're devouring all of their resources. And they've got nobody to lead them and nobody to go against them in battle. And they're terrified of them. And now they get desperate. They're really, really getting desperate now. So they seek out Jephthah because, hey, man, this guy is not afraid of anybody. Let's go to him and see if he'll deal with them. So they go to Jephthah and he says, well, hey, now you come to me? He says, the only way I'm going to do this is if you make me your chief, make me your head. And they said, well, that's what we'll do. All right, when they get really desperate enough, then that's what they're going to do. Well, what you see here, I think it's kind of significant as far as this man. Even though he was kind of ostracized from the society, look at God picked him up and used him in spite of it. And now he's got to go to war against Ammon. Anybody remember who Ammon is? The Ammonites? Who's Ammon?
The younger son of Lot.
Right. Right. Remember Lot's situation where Lot's daughters, the older daughter, they got their father drunk in order to have an inheritance, in order to keep their family line going. So the older daughter got her father drunk, Lot drunk, and she had sexual relations with him when he didn't even know it. And she conceived, gave birth to Moab, and then the younger one went in the night after that, and she conceived and gave birth to Ammon. Well, here's the thing. I think it's kind of significant. We've got all kinds of Ammonites in the church today. And what I mean by an Ammonite or a Moabite is a person who claims to be God's people, but they're illegitimate. In other words, they haven't been born again, and they haven't turned from their sins. They haven't repented of their sins. They haven't given their life to God, and they're not obeying God. But they're in the church, and they're claiming to have an inheritance. but they're illegitimate. And I don't know. You guys see this, the paper? Well, actually, I don't know. This was yesterday's paper, below the fold of the New York Times. And it talks about these gays seeking a place among evangelicals. And they show you these two gay guys out there reading their Bible and holding Bible study. And what they don't realize is they're modern-day Ammonites. They're modern-day Moabites. In other words, they're in the church. They claim to be God's people. They claim to have an inheritance, but they're illegitimate. And I'm not putting these people down. You know, I don't have the one hateful bone in my body towards them. I just feel like, hey, man, except for the grace of God, there goes me. There's no doubt in my mind about it. I don't care what your sin is. You need to repent of it. You got to quit kidding around, you know. I don't care what it is. You've got to quit kidding yourself and trying to do this two-step, because if you don't, you're an Ammonite. You're a Moabite. You can't just simply say, well, God made me this way. You can say that about pedophiles, can't you? I mean, you got to carry this to its ultimate logical conclusion. Here's what people don't understand. We're all sinners. We're all born sinners. We all have this fallen nature with a bent in us to sins. But here's the thing. We all have predispositions for certain sins stronger than other people. You know, some people have a predisposition for, let's say, maybe lust or maybe anger or maybe greed or maybe, you know what I'm saying? We're all sinners. And some of us have stronger predispositions for certain sins. That doesn't mean God made us that way. We have to be honest. We have to call an ace, a spade, a spade. And I didn't want to get off on a tangent here. I'm just simply saying, look what we got to deal with today. The Bible predicted it. It's predicted in Timothy. It's predicted all over the scriptures that in the last days there will be a falling away. There will be an apostasy. You know, there will be a falling away from the truth. But here's the thing. It's not like people are just going to make an about face and say, well, now I'm an atheist. I've been raised in a Christian church all my life, and I just don't believe in God anymore. Those people are few and far between, and believe me. Okay, what's happening is that people are becoming apostates by just simply trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're throwing out sound doctrine, they're throwing out God's word, they're throwing out the Bible, and they're just doing their own thing, just like they did in Judges. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. Well, you know, I just kind of set that stage here as far as Jephthah is concerned, because now he's going to war with the Ammonites, and the Ammonites claim to have an inheritance. They claim that, hey, this is land is ours, we're going to heaven. And believe me, those are some of the hardest battles to fight, is inside the church. You know where your enemy's coming from outside the church, and they're a lot easier to deal with. When you got a fifth column inside the church, I mean, that's really the tough one. And so here it is that this Jephthah is given, you know, basically free rein as far as he's leading these people. But I think what's kind of significant, look what it says here. Go back to verse 11. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and then the people made him head and chief over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. In other words, Jephthah was a man of faith. Okay, he believed in God. But he's one bad dude. You know, people just don't mess with him. He's just kind of like leading a band of hooligans or outcasts or desperados. Or, you know, he just has a gang and nobody's messing with him. And in verse 12 it says, now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon, saying, what is between you and me that you have come to me to fight against my land? Now what he's doing, I think it shows a lot of wisdom. He's not just going to go off half-cocked and go out there and try to, you know, go to war with Ammon. He's basically going to try to negotiate with him first and saying, hey, can we talk this out? What's the problem here? And verse 13, it says, and the king of the sons of Ammon said to the messengers of Jephthah, because Israel took away my land when they came up from Egypt from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan, therefore return them peacefully now. But Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the sons of Ammon, and they said to him, thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the sons of Ammon. For when they came up from Egypt, and Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea, and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying that, please let us pass through your land. But the king of Edom would not listen, and they also sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. So Israel remained at Kadesh. Then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon, and they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon, and Israel said to him, please let us pass through your land to our place. But Sihon did not not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Shion gathered all of his people and camped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. And the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Shion and all of his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. So they possessed all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok, from the wilderness as far as the Jordan. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people of Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord your God has driven out before us, we will possess it. And now, are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel, or did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon. But the king of the sons of Ammon discarded the message which Jephthah had sent him. Now, before we go further, now look what Jephthah had done. This guy knows his history, and he knows his Bible, because we remember when we went through the book of Numbers, we went through the Deuteronomy, where these people were, you can't see it on this particular map here, but they weren't given passage to go through this particular land, so they went all the way around and went up through the Arnon here. And they just basically avoided any conflict at all with Moab or with Ammon, and they didn't take any of their territory, they didn't take any of their land. They took all the land on the east side of the Jordan, which was from the king of Sion. And what I'm saying is this, nothing's changed. I mean, thousands of years have come and gone, and look at that little patch of land in Israel. You know, the Bible says, and in Zechariah it says, Israel will become a burdensome stone to the whole world. You know, this is basically the tiniest nation on earth. Some parts of Israel is not even more than 2 miles wide. And most of the land that they conquered during the Six-Day War in 1967, I mean, the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights and all these other territories, they've been giving it back, little piecemeals at a time, giving back what they had already conquered. I mean, to try to find some kind of peace and appeasement and things like this. And here we are in the same situation today. People just twist and they will tweak and they will distort and they will torture history to try to turn it around and say, this land belongs to us. And yet, it's very clear that this land belonged to Israel because God just flat out gave it to him. It had nothing to do with the Moab. It had nothing to do with the Ammon, because what the God gave the promised land to Israel, who got kicked out of the promised land? It was all the Canaanites. All I'm saying is this. You see what's really happening here is, once again, we see what's really the motive here. Remember what James says? He says, what's the source of all your quarrels among you, brethren? You envy, you covet, you lust after what is not yours, and therefore you murder to get it. That's really at the bottom of it, and people will completely deconstruct history in order to get what they want. And what's at the bottom of it? It's just selfishness, it's greed, it's envy, it's covetousness, it's jealousy, it's resentment, it's bitterness. I mean, this is what's really at the root of it. And here, Jephthah, he just gives them the flat-out truth of what really took place there, that this land does not belong to Ammon at any particular time, and it belongs to Israel. So now diplomacy is basically wearing itself out. It's getting nowhere. So this is the end result, beginning of verse 29. Now the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and then he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's. Or, and a footnote says, and you could put and there, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hands, and he struck them with a very great slaughter from Aroer to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel Kir 8 men. so that the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. And when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came about when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me. For I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." So she said to him, "My father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon." And she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions." And then he said, "Go." So he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions, and they wept on the mountains because of her virginity. And it came about at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which she had made, and she had no relations with a man. Thus it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year, or 4 days out of the year. You know, this is kind of significant. I think there's been a lot of contention about what has really transpired here, because some people say, well, what happened there is that when God gave this tremendous victory to Jephthah, that, well, let me just back up a little bit. He made this vow to God. And the vow to God basically was this: if you will give me victory, whatever comes out of my house, I'm going to dedicate it to you. I'm going to offer it up to you as a burnt offering. And a lot of people, I think, have made the erroneous conclusion that what he was saying was he was going to offer up whoever came out of his house as a burnt offering unto the Lord. In other words, they were going to sacrifice this human being on the altar. And I don't believe that for 1 minute, because if you look at the context here, what it's really saying is this. He was saying that whoever comes out of my house to greet me, he was going to dedicate this individual to the Lord. In other words, he was probably assuming that it might have been one of his wives or one of his concubines or one of his maidservants or one of his servants that was going to come out of his house. And then he was going to say, "Okay, I've made a vow to God. You are now to go into God's service totally and completely. I'm no longer going to possess you," basically saying, "I'm giving you over to God." I guess it's kind of like the same way when we go through the book of Samuel, where we'll read about how Hannah gave her son Samuel to the Lord, dedicated him unto the Lord. That's what he meant by that dedication. It didn't mean that, well, he was going to turn around and put this person on the altar and burn this person. He did make, in my opinion, a rash vow. He made this kind of rash vow. I think that what he probably should have done, if he wanted to make a vow to God, is either a vow something out of his herds or his flocks or something of that nature. Or if he's going to do it in his house, someone of his household, he should have chosen ahead of time who he wanted to dedicate unto God. All right. But here's the thing. I think it's kind of significant. You go back to the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews. And there, that 11th chapter is basically the chapter that defines the God's heroes as far as faith is concerned. I mean, you read that 11th chapter, it's a faith chapter. It talks about Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. It mentions Jacob. It mentions Joseph and Moses and Rahab. And it also mentions Gideon and Barak. And it mentions Samson and Jephthah as being heroes of faith. That this was a man of great faith. Now, this was a man, and it's interesting to me, he's a bad dude. I mean, nobody wants to mess with Jephthah because he had gotten such a reputation. But he doesn't put his faith in the fact that, hey, man, no man's ever been able to stand up against me. I mean, he doesn't put his faith in himself. He puts his faith in God. In other words, he realizes this is way beyond what I can gain victory over. He looked to God for help in this situation because the sons of Ammon obviously were far outnumbering his troops or his army. And I think it's kind of significant. God has him mentioned there in the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews as one of the heroes of faith. Because even though he was considered to be a man who had a tremendous reputation for being a great warrior, a valiant warrior, he didn't look at himself as being that. He thought, hey man, I can't do this apart from the power of God working through me. I can't do this apart from God's help. See, that takes a lot of faith. All right, what are we told in Micah? What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with the Lord your God? Well, you see this kind of situation that even though he was had a reputation for being such a bad dude, he still looked to God for victory. But the unfortunate thing is You know, he's a man of feet of clay. He makes a rash vow, and now he's got to pay the vow. Well, the vow that he makes is his daughter comes out of his house, and she's got a tambourine, and she's singing, she's praising God, and she's, you know, basically praising her father because of this great victory. And when he sees her, he tears his robe in total grief and frustration, feeling like, oh, man, not you. How, you know, he didn't expect her to come out of his house, the first one out of there. He was just going to dedicate some servant unto God, but it was happened to be his daughter. Well, it didn't mean that now he's going to offer up his daughter on an altar and burn her on an altar, because the guy obviously knew his Bible. He knew Israel's history. He knew what was recorded in Numbers and in Deuteronomy as far as Jewish history. And he obviously knew what was recorded in Leviticus, where it says that anybody that offers up their child to Moloch or to others in a fire, that's an abomination to God. So he wasn't going to offer his daughter up on an altar, and some people have criticized him for doing this or suggested that this is what he meant. But if you read the context, what is it talking about here? She went to weep for her virginity. Look at that verse 37. And she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions." And so he said, "Go." And so he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and wept on the mountains because of her virginity. Now, it says that twice, and it came about at the end of the 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which she had made, and she had no relations with man. You see, look at that context. I don't see where it's so hard to see this. What he's really saying is he's basically saying, I've dedicated you to the Lord. You can't get married because you can't belong to a man. What you need to do is basically, hey, now live a life that's totally dedicated to him in prayer and fasting and maybe serving him in some capacity down at the tabernacle or helping the priest or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? So she could no longer be married because he dedicated her to God as a burnt offering. A burnt offering was a whole offering. Her whole life had to be dedicated to God. Unfortunately, he made that rash vow. All right, but you got to give the guy credit. Because he didn't renege on it. His daughter paid a hefty price, but so did he. How?
He lost the son.
Well, yeah, that was the end of his line. As far as his heritage was concerned, or he had no legacy to pass on, no name to pass on. See what I'm saying? You know, so it was quite a sacrifice for him. Anybody have any want to add or share to what we just read there? Yeah.
So it didn't say he obviously was married, otherwise it wouldn't be a daughter.
Right.
It didn't say. And also, so when the prostitute gave birth to him, she must be saying, well, this is your son, take it. That's when he was living with his stepfather.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. And apparently that's what happened because, you know, Gilead is Jephthah's father. He did not marry, okay, Jephthah's mother. All right. But he did raise Jephthah. But then when his brothers came along and said, hey, man, you got no inheritance with us. And they just ran him out of town. See what I'm saying? Is that what your question was?
Right, but he didn't get any punishment. I guess and it's okay for a man to be having a legitimate child.
Well, no, it wasn't okay. It wasn't okay at all. Yeah, it's a good question because he fathered a child out of wedlock. Obviously, he had broken God's moral law. Right, but still, my point is this: it seems like God just kind of overlooks everything with almost sublime indifference when it comes to all this human dysfunction and human frailty and human misery and faults and sins and all these other things. He's just looking for somebody who will believe. Because see, that's why we're saved. We are saved by faith and not by works. But this is what God looks for. Well, here's a man who had everything going against him, but he believed God. And God used him as a great deliverer. That's what I'm saying. As far as God is concerned, there are no illegitimate children. I mean, they're illegitimate parents, right? But the problem is, too, the children got to carry that stigma around, and they got to suffer the consequences of their parents' sins. It just happens. That's part of it. But I think this is here for our instruction to show, hey, man, even if you've got that strike against you in life, it doesn't mean that God has put you on a shelf and he can't use you, you know? Because if these people would just turn to God. Like, how many guys in prison because they don't have a father? Well, if they turn to God as their father, it can really get their life turned around. Remember Jerry Graham? He wrote a book called Where Flies Don't Land. And as a matter of fact, he came to Bible study a few times, and he was involved with the EA. I don't know. Gail's probably the only one who remembers him. Anyway, he became a habitual criminal, and they hauled him away to Carson City. to spend the rest of his life behind bars. But then, he had a conversion there, and God got him out of prison. And he looked to God as being his father, and he turned his whole life around, and he started his farm, which was an orphanage for kids. And you see what I'm saying? I mean, this guy, he was like Jephthah in a sense. I mean, he had all these strikes against him, but God turned around and used him simply because of a man. If he's willing to give his life to God, dedicate his life to God, commit to God, follow God, obey God, God can salvage anything. You can see this in the man Jephthah. Anyway, it says in verse 1 of chapter 12, it says, "Then the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they crossed the Zaphon, and said to Jephthah, 'Why did you cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you.' And Jephthah said to them, 'I and my people were at great strife with the sons of Ammon. When I called you, you did not deliver me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the sons of Ammon, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come to me this day to fight against me?'" Now this is kind of significant. Do you remember what happened to Gideon? When Gideon went to war against Israel's enemies, Ephraim did the same darn thing to him. When he went out there and had a tremendous victory, then Ephraim comes along and says, "Hey man, why don't you call us to the battle?" And Gideon was a lot more diplomatic. He says, "Well, what have I done compared to you guys? You guys have already, killed two of the Midianite kings." So he subdued their anger. But Jephthah, he's not going to mess with these guys. Ephraim comes to him and says, "Hey, why don't you call us to battle?" And he says, "Hey, I called you to battle, but you didn't come to my aid. So I said, to heck with you. I got to get going." So he went to battle and he won the victory. So what's Ephraim's problem? Just think for a minute. What is their real motive here?
Pride.
Well, not just that.
Some victory, some glory.
Well, more than that.
Man.
Huh?
Man.
What do you always get? What does a victor always get in war?
Spoils.
They always get the spoils, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see what's really happening here. I mean, this is the part of the map that probably should be looking at here. Here's Ephraim here, right? And, here Jephthah goes out and he's... He fights on his side against the sons of Ammon, gets this tremendous victory, and then Ephraim gets wind of it, and they go out to fight him. What they really want, what their real motive is, in my opinion, is, hey, we want this spoiled. We want these spoils of war. And Jephthah is not going to give them the time of day. He just says, "Hey, I called you, you didn't want to help me, so I went it alone. So get lost." That's basically what he's telling him. But I think this is instructive, because read on, because what it says here, in verse 4, it says, "Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead, and he fought Ephraim, and the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim, because they said, 'You are fugitives from Ephraim, O Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh.' And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan opposite Ephraim, and it happened when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, 'Let me cross over,' the men of Gilead would say to them, 'Are you an Ephraimite?' And if he said no, then they would say to him, 'Now say Shiboleth.' But he said Seboleth, for he could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. Thus there fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim." Now, they all crossed over the Jordan to go to war. Well, basically, it was Jephthah that crossed over. And then, Ephraim crosses over here to fight with him, pick a fight with him. So they get this big fight going on here, and then Jephthah's men, they block up the fords of the river so that Ephraimites who are trying to get back to their hometown, to their tribe, they are stopped at a roadblock there at the fords of the river. And what's kind of significant is that they'd say to them, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And if they said no, there was a way they could tell, because I guess the Ephraimites, they had a dialect where they couldn't pronounce their S's very well. And when he says pronounce Shiboleth, they would say Seboleth. And anybody who said Seboleth, they knew darn well they were lying and an Ephraimite. And they put him to death right there. And I think that's kind of significant. I think it does have a spiritual parallel. I'm not trying to make too much of a mental leap here, but I think it's true. It's like people's words are always going to give them away. If people say, "Well, yeah, I belong to Christ." Well, then you kind of push the issue and find out where they stand on certain issues concerning sound doctrine. And you can tell right away whether they really belong to God or not. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not that often when I'm witnessing to a person and I will say something to the effect that, who is Jesus Christ to you, that they will turn around and give me the right answer. I had this experience last week. I was witnessing to one of the head clerks at work, and I asked him that. And, you know, he says, well, he's God. I says, you know what? You're absolutely right. Now, what are you going to do about it? Well, you know, he says, I believe, but I don't go to church, and I don't do this, and I don't do that. And, well, he knows. He has the head knowledge, but it's not in his heart. You see, so that tells me, too, if you can identify him, but he's not the most important thing in your life, then your words give you away. You see what I'm saying? I don't want to make a stretch that too far, but I think that's kind of significant because your words are going to make or break you in the end, just like it did with these guys who couldn't pronounce this word. Go back to that verse 6, I guess it says, and they would say to him, now say Shiboleth, but he would say Siboleth, for he could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slew him at the fords of the Jordan. Thus they fell at that time 42,000 of Ephraim. That's a lot of men. 42,000? I mean, I was in the Vietnam War, and, you know, 58,000 guys went down that rat hole and came back in body bags. But that was over, a decade. He says, and Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. Now, Ibzan the Bethlehemite judged Israel after him. And he had 30 sons and 30 daughters whom he gave in marriage outside the family. And he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. Now, this was just a minor judge of Israel. We don't know a whole lot about him, but what we're reading here, he was extremely, I guess, wealthy, and he was very influential and very powerful because he says that he gave his sons and daughters outside their tribe. So he consolidated through marriage, I guess, a lot of just a network of connections throughout all of Israel. That made him, I think, a very successful judge. And that's basically all we know about this guy. And then in verse 10 it says, and Ibzan died, and he was buried in Bethlehem. Now, Elon, the Zebulunite, judged Israel after him, and he judged Israel 10 years. And Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried at Ajalon in the land of Zebulun. Now, Abdon, the son of Hiel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel after him, and he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hiel, the Pirathonite, died, and he was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the hill country of the Amalekites. Now, this is another, I guess, just a minor judge of Israel. We know hardly anything about him, but he had 40 sons, 30 grandsons, who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. I think what it's basically saying here is he was a very wealthy man, very influential man, but if he judged Israel, the suggestion here is that he was a godly man. And it's not impossible, but it's very, very difficult if a person gets in a position of fame and popularity and power. You know, these politicians, the old adage, he says, power corrupts, total power corrupts totally. Well, this is what happens constantly. But every once in a while, I'm assuming from what we read here that he judged Israel and he was a godly man and he did a good job as far as his leadership was concerned, in spite of the fact that he had a great deal going for him as far as wealth was concerned. But let's face it, most people can handle poverty and difficulty a lot better than they can handle prosperity. I mean, there are people who can handle it. I mean, you can see it in the Bible. You see people like Daniel, or see people like Job, or you see people like Joseph. But they're rare. They're rare. Usually when you get into a position of power and influence and money and prestige, you get corrupted. Look what happens to all these politicians. I mean, I went to the polls, last month. I just held my nose and voted because I was so sick and tired of these politicians who have promised so much and they just get corrupted when they're in there. But it's still possible. But in order for it to be possible, I really think you got to have a tremendous depth in your prayer life. And got to be seeking God constantly. I mean, I live by this scripture. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. He will direct your paths. And I really think that if, these people in influence, power, prestige, politics, whatever, if they would live by that, you know, we wouldn't have half the problems that we have today. Before I forget, did you guys see this article in the B? Did you guys hear about this new game that got out, this video game? Anyway,
Left Behind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, did you hear about that? It's a new game. It's targeted largely at conservative Christians. It is a violent video game with a difference. Its combatants on one side pause for prayer, and their favored interjection is "Praise the Lord." And what it does is it basically glorifies violence against non-Christians, and they're trying to portray Christians as being a bunch of people out there, you know, I guess fighting people or killing people who don't believe like them. But the whole game is trying to make it look like what's done in self-defense. It says here in the paper, our game includes violence but excludes blood and decapitation and killing of police officers. But it also says you can lose points for unnecessary killing or regain them through prayer. But what it's really doing is just making Christians look like, you know, violent loose cannons or these right-wing extremist groups that are just full of hate. That's what this game is doing. And what I'm saying is we're in this warfare. We're in a spiritual war. And I'm seeing we're losing it. We're losing the culture war. And more Christians are being lambasted and made to look so foolish. But I think, boy, if you read in Revelation, what does it say? Hey, what's going to happen in the tribulation period is we're not going to be fighting the Antichrist, all right, with guns and bazookas and hand grenades and machine guns, this type of thing. It says, hey, this is the way it's going to come down. Whoever is destined to go to die by the sword is going to die by the sword. Whoever is destined to go to prison is going to go to prison. And Jesus himself said, he who lives by the sword is going to die by the sword. So what if this is one more thing. We're talking about this warfare that we're in. It's one more example, in my opinion, of just how Christians are just being painted with this brush that, hey, man, you people are dangerous and you're fanatical. You can see it, how we're becoming more and more hated, just like Jesus said. Anybody want to add or share?